I'm Sharon Hargrave. I'm the director of the Boone Center for the Family here on Pepperdine's campus. I just want to tell you a couple of brief things about the Boone Center for the Family.
Do you want this?
Thank you, Scott. I just want to tell you a brief couple of brief things about the Boone Center for the Family, and then I'm going to introduce Scott, and you are in for a treat this morning. I'm so excited to have you here with us. At the Boone Center, we have a lot of different programs, but two of the programs I want to tell you about this morning. One is our Relationship IQ program. We have some cards at the back about this. Relationship IQ is designed for young people 18 to 28 year old. Talks a lot about different relationships, dating, sex, parents, roommates, all those kind of things that you're dealing with in that age period. And it's a curriculum that is easy to teach in many different formats. We also have a training for that this Friday afternoon. If you're interested in learning more about Relationship IQ, you can talk to Holly or I at the end of the session, and we'd be glad to tell you a little bit more about that. We also have a program called Marriage Strong. Marriage is designed for young couples that are going into ministry or that are in ministry, and I'm just going to be outright and say all of us who have a worldview of Christ, that we want to help change the world for Christ in some way, are in ministry. So this curriculum really helps people understand themselves in their own conflict and conflict resolution, and helps them understand how they relate to their spouse, which in fact, when we learn how to do that relationship well, we do a lot of other relationships a whole lot better. So again, if you want to learn more about that, we'd love to share that with you as well. We also have some cards at the back of the room if you want to get on our mailing list. We'd love to have you getting our infrequent, but we only send out emails when we think it's really, really significant. So Scott Stanley, I'm so excited to have Scott here with us today. Factually, you know, the things I tell you about Scott is that he is a research professor and a co-director for the Center for Marital and Family Studies at the University of Denver. On a personal note, I would tell you that I've been following Scott Stanley. I've been a Scott Stanley groupie for about 20 years. He is a fascinating researcher that really pulls you into the research and helps you understand what's happening with couples, and has been working in this area for many years, so the research is just incredible. And what I've learned from Scott about couples and about dealing with couples through the years has really enhanced my own work with couples. The other thing I would say is that in our day and age and time, to say to somebody, well, Scripture says that we should approach things this way, somehow doesn't always answer their questions. And what is fascinating, and what Scott's going to tell you about today, is how what we're taught in Scripture about monogamy, about being committed to one person, how if we take Scripture away and just look at it from a research standpoint, how that is also the most healthy way to live, not only for ourselves, but for society as well. So the next time you're in a conversation with someone in your congregation or your friend or your kid that says, you know, I think we're just going to move in with each other to test it out for a little bit, you're going to have some really interesting things to share with them. So please welcome with me Scott Stanley.
Well, good morning. Good morning. Very glad to be here. This is my favorite talk to give. You can all decide if it's your favorite talk to get. So we'll see in a bit what you think about that. There's also, in addition to the handout, there's this brochure in the back. And if you either email on the back there, or if you fill in your email on this card, we have this new personality teaching workshop kit that we'll send you for free if you're interested. That's not related to what I'm talking about today, but it's like the newest thing we have on our team. So check that out if you want. It's something for free and completely up to you. So this talk is called Sliding Versus Deciding, Cohabitation, Commitment, and Marriage. And I'm going to talk particularly about how relationships develop these days and what's difficult about how relationships develop, particularly focused on how research on cohabitation has gotten us to some really interesting insights about the development of commitment and how commitment develops in relationships over time. But let's start off with a few foundational points. So why is commitment even necessary? I probably don't have to really convince most of you that it is, but let's talk about a few reasons. People really do want lasting love. Regardless of everything else that's changed and what people do that's different now or what people do that maybe doesn't really help their odds of achieving that, that's what people want. They want lasting love, and that requires a foundation that makes it secure to really invest for the future. Societally, we know it's very clear now, and researchers hardly argue about this anymore, although there's a few holdouts, but children really do best on average when they're raised by their own two parents. And we live in a society and a culture where the most dramatic change, I'm 59 years old, the most dramatic change in my lifetime and in many of your lifetimes is the unbelievable increase in the number of children that are born into low commitment contexts. And by that I mean that's a fancy way of saying the number of children keeps going up that are born to couples who haven't often even decided they want a future together, much less that they are going to raise a child together, and now here's a child. And that has dramatic implications for society, for social policy, for government expenditures, none of which I'm going to talk about a lot, but it's a big reason in addition to everything I will focus on about why commitment's important and how it develops is important. I also like to say a little bit, this is a Bible lecture series, and I'll mention I think just three passages today, and then mostly I'll be talking about research, but you'll see how it all weaves together. Genesis 2:24-25 is the key passage in all scripture, as you all know, about marriage, which says this: "For this reason a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed." Now the latter part of that verse 25, of course, is saying something about the condition of this sort of perfect state of Adam and Eve before things change, before the fall. But what's also fascinating about that passage is I think it really speaks to what people want deeply in their heart in terms of to be really fully accepted, fully known, to have a really safe relationship that's safe because it's secure, not safe because they can't be who they are. What I want to point out about this passage is everything in the verse before, everything in verse 24 can be thought of as an aspect of a fundamental feature of the way commitment works in relationships. So when it says a man shall leave his father and mother, that's a real statement about priority. That's a statement about what I'm doing now compared to the reverence I have to my parents, that this new thing is a very high priority. And the word joined there, which says joined to his wife, when the two people are joined together, that's the Hebrew word dabak, and it's like epoxy glue. It's a word used to describe a really strong, permanent connection between the things that are joined. And then lastly, this idea of one flesh. This idea of oneness is really the core of the theology of marriage in virtually all Christian traditions. And it's not that one person's identity gets obliterated in the other, but it's the sort of oneness that you see throughout Christian theology, like in the body of Christ, that there's all these differences and diversity and different things people bring to what the oneness is, but there's a oneness that sort of encompasses all of that. There's a new identity for the couple of an us. It's not that me and you disappear, but the us becomes very strong. And those are all things that you can see very clearly in research on commitment. So my point here is that verse lays out things related to commitment that make possible the kind of security and intimacy that's in the verse after that. And I'm going to talk to you about that from a research perspective. And speaking of research, this is my 15-year-old now lab assistant, Odie. This is the first or second picture I took of my dog, Odie, when we brought him home 15 years ago. He's an old man dog now. In fact, he just had a pretty significant surgery a couple weeks ago, and he's doing very, very well. But this is Odie as a puppy, and he's somewhat internationally famous for me making this point, because it makes a very important point about why commitment is important. And it's this: you fall in love with the front end of the puppy. but every puppy has a back end. Okay. We tend to think in society we have a culture filled with things that are really all about the wonderful, mysterious, enraptured, romantic part of relationships. But just like the puppy, marriages and family relationships have a front end and a back end. And it's not all the cute part. It's not all the part that just greets you with licks and smiles when you come home at night. There's the business end of the puppy as well. And a lot of relationships fail because things aren't worked through on the business end. The back end, which is about regulating time and place and sort of figuring out how you're going to manage these tasks together. And it's about, you know, cleaning up some stuff and holding your nose at times. And you get where I'm going here. So it's not all about the front end. And that's why commitment's really important, because the back end of the puppy needs commitment. The front end of the puppy doesn't really need commitment. The front end of the puppy is just cute and awesome and always, or most always, works. Another reason why commitment's really important for lasting love, and I like saying this, my wife notices and says that I'm somewhat of a bummer, downer kind of person at times. So this may appear that way, but I'm making a very nice, positive, fun-filled point here. Everybody in this room has a body, you probably have noticed. And you may have asked and you may have answered, but I'm going to answer if you haven't. Why do you have a body? I think the best answer to this question is in 2 Corinthians 4, 6 through 7, which says, "We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us." Here's what I get out of that verse in blue. Your body, at some point, sooner or later, it already has, or you notice its beginning, it'll do it gradually, it'll do it suddenly, but it'll do it somehow. Your body will completely humiliate you somewhere in the course of your life, especially if you live long. Your body will make it very clear to you that you are not God. I think that's why we have bodies. We could be spirit beings. We could have, you know, God could have done whatever he wanted, but we have bodies so that we know that the power isn't in us, because our bodies are going to show us that. Now, that has a couple of interesting implications about marriage. One is the fascinating interplay between committed love and decay. This is the part my wife really likes, these sort of cheery sentiments. A really important point about the possibility of love that really lasts and committed love lasting in marriage is that you have two people that have signed on to be there for each other through thick and thin, through whatever throws at them, through whatever they have to deal with the kids, through in-laws, through work, stress, society, but also and especially interestingly over time, what happens in their bodies, things that aren't predictable, or maybe things, some of which may have been predictable before marriage. And what's interesting about committed love in marriage is it's really, when it works, when people really follow through and that commitment and that love continues through life, it's the best opportunity we're ever going to be able to see in this life, outside of the spiritual connection with Christ, the possibility of the fact that we can be imperfect and be loved. Because we're going to be imperfect. We're going to be less and less perfect. And when two people are really making that work in marriage, it's a very powerful thing. And the other reason why having a body really matters to commitment is that chemistry is a big part of love and falling in love. You hear people talk about chemistry all the time and the chemistry of love and what happens. And there is literally chemistry. Now, sometimes people are just saying chemistry like, well, do you fit? Is there a match? Is there a good connection? Were you kind of meant to be together? Whatever all, you know, someone might be saying or thinking. But literally, when we fall in love, there's a lot of chemistry going on. There's adrenaline that really is the excitement and anxiety in terms of new love. Dopamine, which is the fundamental chemical in our minds, our brains, related to pleasure. It's also the fundamental chemical of addictions and things like that. Oxytocin. Now, there's many others. Oxytocin I like to talk about a lot because I think it has a very interesting interplay with commitment. But oxytocin, and it has a lot of mysterious elements. One of the things that people broadly seem to assume that oxytocin does that's very positive in relationships is it bonds people together. So oxytocin is the chemical that floods through a woman's body at birth, which really starts off strongly the process of bonding to the child. But we also have a lot of oxytocin, males and females. Now, females have, I think, more oxytocin, a more robust oxytocin system, if you will, because they're the ones that, on average, bear the children. See, if you're a researcher, everything's on average. But that one doesn't seem so average, does it? It's also the released in substantial amounts in people when you touch, when you hug, when you are sexually aroused, when you have sex, just anything related to sort of being physically connected, like in romantic and sexual activity, there's going to be oxytocin released. And oxytocin is the chemical of sort of attachment and bonding. Now, I have some oxytocin spray with me. Now, you may be skeptical of this, it's said on the internet that this was oxytocin spray. And why wouldn't you believe what's on the internet? I actually think it probably could be, though I would love a chemist to sort of test this at one point. I paid $49 for this bottle of oxytocin spray. And just sort of to liven up the room a little bit, just want to make sure you all get attached to me. So
now, we're all attached to you now.
All right, so now I'll be your favorite speaker ever. And actually, I gave a talk this fall. This was a little funny because I was covering this part, and it was to a room filled with college students. And there was one guy right up front. And I was doing this, and he might have gotten the most. And he kind of followed me around like a puppy the rest of the day. It was I don't really think it was because of the spray. Oh, and here, just sort of should be attached to yourself. Now, a serious point about this, I first learned about oxytocin in a USA Today article, my favorite journal, about 15 years ago, and it was a researcher that had been doing studies on oxytocin, an economist named Paul Zak. He actually has a book on it, and there's a number of different studies that have been done. But in particular, what he was doing is these kind of studies where the little game theory kind of studies that became popular in the Cold War, where they would study how people would make bargains in different kinds of highly controlled little experimental conditions. And what he had been doing and other researchers have been doing is seeing how spraying people with a little bit of oxytocin changed the nature of sort of the bargain that they would make. So they're, you know, in a situation with a stranger, and in these sort of game scenarios that are used to test exchanges, it's like a one-shot exchange, and what will somebody give in return to something, what they get. And oxytocin, they find, pushes people in terms of giving more and trusting more in that interchange. Now, what I also thought was funny is I'm reading this article on USA Today, and the researchers were explaining kind of how this worked and some theories about oxytocin. And the line I still remember, because this is what made me laugh, is they said, well, we're sure nobody would misuse this, like, you know, in dating or whatever. I'm like, what country do you live in? Are you serious? You know, this is a front page article on USA Today. People are buying this stuff all over the internet right now and spraying it on themselves or their partner on Friday night. Didn't want to plant that seed in your mind, I'm just saying. It does, by the way, on the bottle, it says to do things like apply to yourself whenever you want to make a lasting impression and create a trusting atmosphere. And I read that to one of my graduate students, and she said, what is that called? It's called Liquid Trust, that's the brand name. And you really can buy this on the internet. You could buy it today. But one of my grad students said, that should be called Liquid Sucker. You know, you want it really sprayed on the other person, right? Not on your, you don't want to make yourself more trusting if you're like buying a car. You want to make it, anyway. If you're going to buy a car, get some, spray it all over the room before the manager comes in where they're really working the money deal with you. Anyway, this is all involved in love. And one of the things that our body really does with all this chemistry and with illness, decay, different things being imperfect, is it reminds us and tells us there's a lot about love and there's a lot about commitment that we don't have control over. What we do have control over is our will. And our will and our decisions, what we decide to do and what we follow through, is very fundamental to how commitment's going to be enacted and how commitment's going to play out between two people over the course of life or a few years, depending on how long they go. But the will is the part we want to focus on because it's the part we can grab and we can do something about. So how this matters or how this develops matters a lot. So how does commitment develop? So this is a very psychological viewpoint. And the point is just that somehow we get attracted. There's some mix of attraction and satisfaction and time spent together. Somehow you meet this person. Increasingly, people do meet in large numbers now electronically. People do meet on the internet in huge numbers, vastly greater numbers than just 10 years ago. And 20 years ago, that would have been relatively unheard of. It could happen, but it was unheard of. Now, it is the most common way that people meet somehow is through a dating site. Church and things like that might be around number two, but dating sites are number one. But anyway, however people meet, let's assume we got two people that have spent time together and there's attraction. And one of the things that's delightfully still pretty mysterious about research on love is that even though we know more about chemistry and we know more about how people meet, it's still pretty mysterious what attracts people to other people. And that's kind of a nice thing. It's nice to have some mystery still laying about. As the couple goes on, something happens that's really pretty interesting and very related to the need for commitment to develop if there's going to be a future for this couple. And that is that there's a really strong attachment, or there's an attachment that starts to form between these two people. And with that attachment, there starts to be some anxiety. And the anxiety is very obvious, and this is not like an attachment disorder anxiety. This is a normal developmental kind of anxiety for the couple that's developing. And the anxiety is, I am so into you, I love you, this is great, we're wonderful together, and now what do I start to fear? I start to fear that it's not mutual, that we won't stay together, that I will lose you. So there's this sort of natural developmental attachment anxiety that's different than like a lifelong attachment disorder that somebody might acquire because of how they're parented or their genetics or the mix of the parenting and the genetics and maybe instability in the home growing up. All that stuff really affects things like attachment insecurity and avoidant attachment and anxious attachment. And if you're those of you that are really into those things and think a lot about that, just take the same model, but then wrap into that the probable fact that we have more and more people being raised now that have to have pretty serious attachment issues than ever before in the history of this country. Because there's so much instability in homes. There's remains of a very high likelihood of divorce, but even becoming more likely, or more, not more likely than divorce, but a very high likelihood now is that couples don't sort of get married in the first place, that a strong bond between the two people doesn't form in the first place. And then, you know, there'll be disruption, there'll be instability, and that person might carry that forward. Commitment, when it really develops and forms well, secures the attachment between these two people. It secures it for the adults and it secures it for the children. And all kinds of forms and customs related to commitment have this function that they essentially make it secure. Now, if you contrast that, so clarity about commitment plays this powerful role in securing attachment. But instead, what you see happening today, and this is another massive change in 40 years or so, is what we have now in the dating and romantic scene and how couples develop is a massive amount of ambiguity. Nothing is clear now compared to 40 years ago, or 60 years ago, or 80, and maybe in the history of the world. There's even, and I've written a number of things, Galena and I have talked about this with other writers, there's a lot of things on the internet. If you look up just, is this a date, or any variation of that, you'll end up at some of my blog stuff and some other things. My blog is slidingversusdeciding.com, by the way, and I write about a lot of this kind of stuff all the time. But this is a real question a lot of people have. Okay, I know we're seeing each other Friday night, but many people are wondering, is it a date? what is a date? What would it be if it was a date? What's different about a date or not? And this just confusion about what a date is, and is this a date? Breakups are confusing now. This is I think that's a term of mine, but they picked it up for a Psychology Today article that interviews me and my colleague, Galena Rhodes. Breakups are not clear and strong even anymore. What happens now is people break up, but they sort of do what I call a soft breakup. They're not really making a clean break. And electronics really come in here strongly, because what people do now is they're like monitoring the prior partner on Facebook. They're sort of still following this other person to see who they're dating, who they start dating. And some people can articulate this idea that, well, I don't really know yet how this current new relationship's going to work out, so I'm going to keep monitoring this. It's like I'm keeping a card back in the card game. You know, I can still, I see what you're saying about the person you're dating. I could still sort of pull you back in if this doesn't work out. All of these things are forms of sort of hedging your bet, of sort of keeping all your options open. Hookups are fundamentally ambiguous. It's not like there's a clear start and beginning and understanding of a relationship. It just starts with sex. Or there could be some sort of friendship, but sex wasn't exactly anticipated, and, you know, here we go. That's ambiguous. And as I'll be saying, cohabitation is a remarkably ambiguous relationship form. And if anything, probably won't go down this path too far, but you could make a strong case that it's actually become massively more ambiguous just in the last 7 to 10 years than even it was 15 years ago or 20 years ago. I'll just make this point one way. Even 15 years ago or so, 20 years ago, when a couple lived together before marriage, unless they were like an anti-marriage couple, or unless there was some reason this couple was just not going to get married, otherwise, everybody around them figured, and the couple figured too, that this was a step on the way to marriage. That's not even true now. In fact, one of the phrases, I don't think I have it in this talk, but something's emerged quite recently that I call cohabitating, which is a form of cohabitating. Correct grammar is really cohabiting, but cohabitating is how sleepovers or just moving in for a while has just become part of the dating scene. But now, for the first time, and this is just in recent years, most cohabiting relationships are actually likely to break up and not end in marriage. So there's a lot of people around that are thinking, well, we have one person thinking, well, we'll move in together and this will be the start of moving toward marriage and all this. And the other may or may not be thinking that, I think often isn't thinking that, and then they'll break up. And then that person has now experienced one break. They're now going to be a serial cohabitor, because they're going to cohabit again. And that often isn't the initial intention. Although for some people now, I think the mindset really is that. It's changed. That I'm not going to get married till I'm 32. And between 20 and 32, I'm going to date a lot of people, I'm going to have sex with a number of people, and I may cohabit with a few different people, just sort of trying things on and experiencing things, and I'll talk about that as we go on. And I want to just suggest that the ambiguity that we see everywhere in the dating scene is motivated. People have massive amounts of marital and family instability now. People have seen a lot of relationships, a lot of marriages not work, and they don't trust it, and they're fearful of it. And these fears are channeled into an aversion to risk. And one of the things that is risky is saying very clearly what I want and what I'm interested in and that I'm very into you. Because the clearer I say what I really want, the more clearly I put myself out there, the deeper rejection I'm risking. Because the more I reveal who I really am, the more you can hurt me close to who I really am. If it's all vague and unclear in what happens today in the dating scene, there's a false sense of security in that. And the ambiguity is actually fine for a while. I mean, it makes sense that you'd have some ambiguity in a relationship that's a new relationship that's developing over some time. But as relationships go on and on, ambiguity becomes dangerous for a really important reason. It's this one, this bullet point. Ambiguity makes it harder to detect asymmetrical commitment. Asymmetrical is, of course, a fancy word for saying uneven commitment. So here's a not fancy picture about what that's like in a relationship. So this is a photo I got from the internet. You can get so much from the internet. It's an amazing thing. I'm not to the end of it yet, but it's amazing. So first off, I just want to make a cultural comment. You might be able to notice that this picture isn't from the United States. I think this is from Asia, or it might be, I think this looks like a picture from Asia. You can't even find teeter-totters in the United States now, right? Because they're too dangerous for our children. If you see a teeter-totter in the United States at this point, it's going to be going from a height of 6 inches up to on the ground, and the kids will be wearing helmets with a phalanx of parents around each side to make sure that nobody gets injured. This photo, look at this wicked teeter-totter. This is an amazing, this little girl, how many feet off the ground is she? She's way, way up there. I don't know, is that 5 feet? It's up there. I never saw one like this as a kid. Of course, I might not have lived if I'd been around one like this as a kid. Now, this is a fabulous picture, this one in particular, of asymmetry. And this is the problem with the teeter-totter, because the teeter-totter is fundamentally a trust play device. Okay, it has the up and down, it has all the kinetic fun and all, but the really interesting thing about the teeter-totter is there has to be some mutual commitment on both sides, or it's really not fun. How many of you ever did play on a teeter-totter as a child, and you can still remember the annoyance at some time doing it with like a sibling who was just enjoying dropping you to the ground, right? That's not really as much fun. Well, it might have been fun for my brother, but not as much fun to be on the dropped end of the teeter-totter. And what I also like about this photo, I wish it was taken a little bit further over, but look at the kid on the blue at the other end. And first, notice how completely committed to the activity the girl is that's 5 feet. She's completely into it. Her legs aren't even down. She's not seeing any kind of risk here at all. And you look at the little kid in blue on the left, the butt's not even all the way on the seat. That person's about to slip off, and we know what's going to happen to the little kid in pink, right? That's what it's like to be in an asymmetrically committed relationship. And one of the things that happens in our society now is, because things are so ambiguous, ambiguity allows relationships to continue much longer than they would have with one person hiding out and not being clear that they're actually really not so into this other person as the other person is to them. So it's very easy, because society now allows it and even reinforces it. It's very easy for relationships to be ambiguous. And the person that's more inclined to commit early, or to commit more, or to be more reliable and more trustworthy, has extra dangers in a world of ambiguous romance and sexual relationships, because they tend to be more all in. And I would say, by the way, that there's a gender difference here. I may say more about this as we go on, but I won't say a lot about this today, unless for some unusual reason I have a massive amount of time left by the time we're done. Then I will, because it's fun stuff to talk about. But I think about 2 to 1, I think it's women that have much more vulnerability here with ambiguity than men. But there's plenty of men that are the more committed type person, or the more committed one in relationships. It's just about 2 to 1 that if there's asymmetry in what we see in different patterns of data that we have, and I say we, I mean me and my colleague Galena Rhodes, that we can find in different data sets we have that, 2 to 1 is not a bad approximation, that when there's asymmetry, about 2 of the times out of 3, the female's the more committed person, and about 1 of the times out of 3, the male's the more committed person. In either case, the person that's the most committed has the most to risk, because the most committed person in any relationship has the least power. Okay? That's an extension of what's called the principle of least interest, which is a principle that goes back to Richard Waller in the 30s and some other people early on. I like to frame it as commitment. The one with the most commitment has the least power. The one that is the most invested has the most to lose, who's most fully in. The other person, when they can exit more easily, and they can do more damage in exiting, because they just need the relationship less, or have invested less in the relationship. Now, Galena and I, we did a report for the National Marriage Project called Before I Do just last year. We had this wonderful long-term data set I'll say a little bit about. This report's online. It's really a terrific report. It covers a lot of the kinds of things we do research. And this particular piece is focused on part of the sample that we followed. We followed a sample of 1,300 individuals in the U.S. in serious romantic relationships over a five-year period. This was a study funded by NIH. And we assessed people on average, about 418 of the 1,300 married, and we assessed people on average of four times before marriage and five times after, pretty much at like a 4 to 6 month interval. So asking them about breakups, asking them about commitment, asking them about sex, cohabiting, just asking them zillions of questions about their relationship and their lives and other things, and then seeing what relates to what. And this report's just a really good, current, accessible report that covers a lot of the kinds of things I'll be talking about, but not everything. You can read a lot of these other things in my blog articles and stuff like that if you want the easy access stuff. But one of the things we asked at every time point was, how committed are you to this relationship? This is like some of the really simple stuff we measured. And another question is, how committed is your partner to this relationship? And we asked those two questions on real simple 7-point scales. And if at any of those time points before marriage, somebody says, like, I'm a 5 and my partner's a 6, or I'm a 4 and my partner's a 3, or I'm a 7 and my partner's a 6, if at any time point they said their number was higher than they said their partner's number was, and 16% at some point did say that, that predictor, and we're looking at things like number of sex partners, cohabiting, family history, prior relationship history, having children before marriage, income, religiosity. I mean, we're looking at all kinds of different predictors. Ever having said, acknowledging to the self that I think I'm 1 point higher or more than my partner before the couple got married, it's the single best predictor in everything we looked at in this report of marital quality. And so ever perceiving that your partner's less committed isn't a good sign for the future. Now, commitment asymmetries can be cured, they can be flushed out. People can really have strong, you know, kind of like conversion experiences of being equally committed and all. But a lot of people assume that that just happens because you got married. And there's a lot of reason I'll show you to assume that that doesn't just happen because people got married. It happens a lot, whether there's symmetry or not, earlier based on how the couple develops. And I'll talk about some of these other predictors as we move on. But if you're meeting with somebody, an individual, friend, whatever, and they're thinking about marrying somebody, but they really keep bringing up sort of examples where they seem to be more invested and interested in this relationship and making it happen than the other, you really want to actually pull them aside and talk a bit about whether they should keep pursuing that person. One of the ways I've said this to people before is if you feel like you have to chase down the other person and eventually kind of drag them to the altar, it's the sign of many draggings to come for the rest of your life. Because if you have to drag them to the altar, him or her, you're going to be dragging them through life if you make very far into life. So it's a big deal. Now back to societal conclusions for a second. So I believe we have a society where we have increasing attachment insecurities accompanied by this growing ambiguity, which is reflected in the loss of steps and stages and sequence. So there's a sense of a loss of sort of rules about courtship or a sense of what you do or what things mean and how you sequence things. Let me give you a really good example and an example of the implication of this. When I was in high school and junior high, which was 43 or so years ago, I know I don't look like I could possibly be that old. My body is telling me I will decay and die. Keep that in mind. It's a spiritual thing. So when I was in high school, it was still very common that people did something called going steady. How many of you remember going steady? If you don't remember going steady, you're young. If you do remember going steady, you're not old. You're perfected. So here's how Go and Study works. So it was such a cultural normative expectation about the progression of the relationship. If you had been dating for a while in high school, everybody's wondering when you're going to start going study. People are sort of waiting for an announcement that you're going to be going study. And I wouldn't pin it down to like a 4 week, 8 week, 3 week, 3 month. I forget, it's not like an exact time, except that within a particular high school, I'm sure there was sort of an average expected time, and people would be sort of watching and waiting to see if it would happen. They're waiting for this announcement that you're going steady. Now, here's what I want you to think about, is when you have things like that in the culture that are pushing a public mutual expression of commitment. Public and mutual are really, I don't think this is in your notes, but so public mutual expressions of commitment are really powerful for taking care of problems of asymmetry. Because one of the things you didn't do in high school in my day, you looked really stupid if you started telling other people that you were going steady before your partner knew it. Not a smart move. You weren't going to look like a smooth operator doing that, right? You know, 'cause just think of the humiliation. Well, she says you're not. Well, that's a bad sign, right? I thought we were. Maybe it was somebody else. The fact that everybody's expecting that to happen in a short order, a certain amount of time, is very interesting because it means if it doesn't happen, that's informative. There's information in that. It says something about the relationship. And one could start wondering they were in a particular culture, for example, where they expected one or the other to sort of raise it first, they could start wondering, well, what's wrong with us or your commitment to me that you're not raising this or bringing this up or that it's not happening? That's really useful information. Now, today, I said a moment ago, cohabitation's ambiguous. And it's a great example of this. I will not only tell you this strongly, I just am even more convinced of this each year that goes by in terms of findings that come out. Cohabitation contains no information about commitment. If a couple walks up to you at a party and you're meeting them for the first time and they tell you, we're living together, and let's say you don't know anything else, you know they're living together, I'm going to guarantee you, you know nothing about the level of commitment in that relationship. You know absolutely nothing. There's a few communities where you might know something, and those are going to be communities where marriage is obliterated and cohabitation has taken on some sort of information about a higher level of commitment, which can be some of the really impoverished parts of communities where cohabitation often still is meaningless there too, but you can find some couples where it means something. And there's really just not an ability to afford a wedding, or there's not an ability to afford a divorce from an actual marriage that happened before, and the cohabitation might be informative. But for most of the folks, most of you are running into, it says nothing. If somebody says, we're engaged, you know a massive amount about commitment. If somebody says, oh, well, we don't believe in marriage, but we're life partners, you know pretty much about a commitment to the future. You know, these are real signals that mean something about commitment. Cohabitation in and of itself doesn't. And of course, having a child doesn't mean anything either about a commitment to the future. So back to that go and study thing. There's a great article, forget the author's name, but it was just in this Sunday's New York Times. It's about labels and relationships and ambiguity today. It's really good. These pieces appear now because people sense it. Smart writers can kind of describe the dating scene now. And this woman's describing sort of this relationship that never kind of got all the way to turning into anything in her life. But one of the things that she said is fascinating, and she said that whenever she tells her father, who's probably somebody my age, that she's in a relationship with a guy, she doesn't even like to bring it up anymore because the first thing he asks is, are you going steady? Which she understands what he's saying. He says, do you have a label for this relationship? Is there something publicly declared? Is there some information about the commitment? Now, the only thing that's appeared, as most of these things have disappeared, engagement is still around, mostly for the better off as a device. Going steady's obliterated. Facebook thing is a really interesting emergence of sort of a new kind of similar thing culturally. Because there sometimes is this expectation of, well, are we going to be official, Facebook official? I understand from things I read, I don't know this by way of data, that that's sort of fading now and people are sort of reluctant to use that tool, which would make a lot of sense if there really is a lot of motivation toward ambiguity, then people will be using that less and less over time. And I've heard that's the case, but I could be wrong. But ambiguity, there's a reason why there's so much ambiguity, and there's a cost to there being so much ambiguity, because lots of people are in relationships that aren't going anywhere, and they don't even have clear information yet that that's the way it's going to be. So if commitment matters, it matters how it develops. Now I want to put two concepts on the table that will help me talk about the rest of what I want to say, and particularly using research on cohabitation that we do and others do to frame this discussion. You can think of commitment in a lot of ways, and this is how I've thought of it over the years, in particular the two dimensions, and then there's a lot of subdimensions of these two, in terms of how I like to think about measuring it and what we do in our work. One aspect of commitment is what we think of, or what you could think of, as personal dedication. When I say dedication, what I mean and what people historically have meant in the commitment literature is that intrinsic devotion to another, to a project, to a task. It's that wanting to give, wanting to be identified with this person, seeing a future, investing in the future, protecting the relationship from attractive alternatives, being willing to sacrifice for the partner. That's all of what's in dedication. And in fact, as a researcher, what we measure in terms of dedication and the measures that I've developed for dedication, if you looked at them, you could actually, and looked carefully at 1 Corinthians 13, you would see dedicated commitment is a whole lot like agape love. So the stuff you see described in 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind, you know, not self-seeking, long-suffering, all those kinds of things there, really are reflecting a similar kind of construct as what I, as a researcher, call dedication. The other side, though, here is really important, and that's often not thought a lot about, but it operates importantly in people's lives, which is the concept of constraint. So constraint's the aspect of commitment that relates to the likelihood that somebody would feel compelled to continue a relationship, and this is an important detail, whether or not they want to continue the relationship. So the dedication's closer to the want to, and the constraint's closer to the have to. And the have to is made up things like, what's it going to cost me to leave? Which could be literal costs, or am I going to lose friends? What would my parents think? What about children, if we have children, and concern for their welfare? If I want to be in a relationship, but I don't want to be in this relationship, one of the constraints is my perception of whether other people that I could be interested in would be interested in me. If I don't think other people would be very interested in me, then I'm more constrained. So marriages and relationships, religious beliefs, obviously about divorce. Once you're talking about a married couple, that can be a constraint too. Here's the thing about constraints before I move on to use these terms. To define them, you have to put it in sort of a negative kind of cast, because you can't get the list right if you don't say what keeps somebody there when they might want to leave. Most of the time, and most marriages, over time, constraints do something very positive, even though the definition makes them sound a little negative, especially to people in a culture that are consumed with the concept of personal choice. What constraints do that's really good for a marriage is they function like guardrails during periods of time when we're really being stupid, and we might undo a whole lot of investment together in a short period of time if we didn't have something that was saying, oh, wait a minute, there's this and this and this and this, it's going to cost you, you can't do that, you're going to lose contact with your kids, your parents aren't going to approve, you're going to have a conscience issue, maybe you can't afford to move out. I honestly think I can't tell you what number, but out of 100 marriages, I would bet it's a single digit number that would stay together for 40 years or more, stay together for life, without some serious amount of constraint commitment. Because I think most marriages are going to hit some period of time where things are tricky enough, painful enough, dicey enough, uncertain enough, or something else is tempting enough that the marriage will crumble in the face of that without the guardrails that constraints provide. Obviously, though, constraints alone don't produce a great marriage. It's really keeping dedication alive and thriving and strong that can do that. That's like the agape love part.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why would you use constraints instead of consequences?
Consequences would be fine. Constraints is a little more robust word. You'll see how I use it as we go along, because consequences isn't as broad. So constraints are a kind of, consequences are a type of constraints, but there's sort of more to it. So you could it's fine to think of it that way. You can think of it as obligations. You could think of it as, what's another term? Structural commitments, a term Mike Johnson uses, which sort of are the things around a couple that build and accumulate. There's a lot of different terms, but constraints a little more all-purpose because it gets right at kind of motivation and how what you want to might be constrained by other things in your life, which is going to be related to consequences. So sliding versus deciding. I want to give you a sense of the history of this and research on cohabitation that will then further talk about essentially how this interplay and the timing of dedication and constraint plays a really interesting role in how relationships develop these days and the likelihood of people being successful in relationships. And a lot of this, again, is work that I do with my colleague, Galena Rhodes, who, by the way, is a brilliant researcher. And she is, we're both good researchers. I won't say I'm brilliant, but I'll say she's brilliant. But the in other ways, she's everything I'm not. She's young. She's female, she's not religious, she's not conservative, she's liberal. What else is there? Is that enough? Now we both have great families and all that, but you know, I'm none of those things. And what's fascinating about our work together is we agree on so many, an overwhelmingly important number of the things I'm about to describe to you. It's just amazing, because there's a lot of things we don't agree on. And there's a lot of things that are so different about our cultural backgrounds and our worldviews. But when we get to research in this area, we just see stuff the same way. And it's been a pretty powerful model, because this works for people from across a pretty large spectrum. Now, let's talk about the cohabitation effect. The cohabitation effect is the fact that historically in research on marriage, living together before marriage has been associated with greater odds of divorce, lower marital satisfaction, more conflict, and poorer communication. And really, about anything you could measure related to marital quality has tended to look worse for people that lived together before marriage. That's for about the last 40, 50 years, these findings come up in study after study after study after study. Now, they've weakened recently, or at least they seem to weaken. I have different theories about whether they're really weaker or not, but I'll just stipulate for the fact that maybe the effect has weakened in the last 10 or 15 years. I'm going to tell you in a moment that some people believe it's completely gone, and I'm going to tell you why that's actually not true. But I don't mind whether it's weakened or not. I think it might have weakened, but I actually think it's just sort of popping up in more nuanced ways now. But this, even if it's weakened a lot, or let's say it had completely disappeared, and I'm going to tell you why I don't think that's true, on balance, there's still almost no, and I say almost because I'm a researcher and researchers will qualify everything, and I know a couple little findings and a couple pockets of data, but overwhelmingly, there's no evidence that cohabiting before marriage improves one's odds. And I can also tell you, though this is older data, nobody's gotten this data in surveys recently, but I bet it's still true. Living together before marriage is the number one thing that young people believe they can do to improve their odds of doing well in marriage. And it's a fascinating juxtaposition. This doesn't happen a lot, but when it happens, it's always interesting when research has no support for something that's broadly believed. And this is a great example. People really believe that that's going to help them, that they could learn something, that they could decide, well, then this isn't the relationship for us, that we could sort of test the relationship. And before I forget, let me just tell you this one finding from one of the studies that we published, a paper by Galena, me, and Howard Markman. This is probably 2009 or 2010 on reasons for cohabitation. The number one worst answer somebody could say for why they want to live together is to test the relationship. And what it looks like, without going into a lot of details, what I can tell you what the data look like to us is that if you think you need to live together to test the relationship, you actually already had the scores on the exam and you probably should be moving on and not making it harder to break up by living together. So it's just, it's not a good sign in particular. So if people are going to live together, wanting to live together for companionship or to save money, those are actually, from a scientific standpoint, those are a lot better answers than to test the relationship. People that say they want to test, I think they already know the answer. And if they're your friends or your family, you should try to nudge them to slow down and maybe not do that, because it's probably not going to go in a great direction. So every now and then, I think about twice a year, you'll see a massive blow-up of stories in the media about some study that comes out on cohabitation. It's a super popular topic with young adults. The things I've written about cohabitation on my blog, which are many pieces now that describe all these kinds of things I'm talking about at slidingversusdeciding.com, I'm often dealing with pieces in the media or new studies or explaining what's wrong with this study or what's interesting about this current media frenzy. So this is one that happened last year, coming off a study by Ariel Cooperberg. And the upshot in all of these media studies, and this is just one example from Slate, call your dad, living together before marriage does not lead to divorce. Now, I don't know why you wouldn't want to call your mom, but, you know, call your dad. You know, this is joyous, happy news. There's no, you know, it used to be there was a risk. Now, here's the bottom line, and I won't cover every detail of this because I'm going to really jump on that first one to explain our research more. The no added risk headline is only true for a very select group of people. It's true for people that tend to have these characteristics. They don't have to have all of them. Sort of any one of these is part of what gets people into the lower risk category. But these things often sort of all go together, or a couple of them go together in the same person. Those who only began to cohabit after developing mutual clear plans for marriage, like engagement, they don't seem to be looking worse. I'm just speaking scientifically in terms of living together before marriage. Those who, this is a big one, only ever cohabited with the person that they married. Remember that example I gave earlier? Somebody's like starting to live with somebody, they thought, wow, this is cool, this is going someplace, they're into me, I'm into them, and then they find out in a few months that, like most cohabiting relationships now, more than half, that they're going to break up before marriage. They experience, well, I guess that really wasn't it. Now I'm likely to be a serial cohabitor, because I thought that was the one, so now who am I going to move in next that I think is the one? Okay. Those who didn't cohabit until they're a bit older, older than 23, or those who didn't didn't have a child before marrying. What's interesting about this kind of headline, there's no more risk, is it's clear in all these different studies that there's risks for people that are on these different paths that aren't in those groups defined by what I'm describing here. So the people that are less deliberate, cohabiting earlier in their lives, cohabiting before there's mutual plans for marriage, all of them are at higher risk. That doesn't mean they're doomed, but they're all at higher risk. And this kind of headline that there's no risk doesn't tell you any of that. And it's really just true for a minority of the people that are going to live together before marriage. Now, explaining the cohabitation effect. There's a number of reasons for the cohabitation effect, but I'm going to focus on two. And one of them is very important to understand, but I won't go into detail on this one. And it's that it's about the people that cohabit. This has been understood for a long time, that people that cohabit versus don't, or people that cohabit, now what's clear in the research is people that cohabit in the higher risk kind of patterns, are people that were already at higher risk for not doing well in marriage. You know, in terms of like the home they came from, their education level, economic background, relationship history, other kinds of factors that put people at risk. That's what researchers mean in this area. When they talk about a selection effect, they mean that the risk here may not be related to living together. It may be that people that are more likely to live together before marriage were people that were already at greater risk. And this is just part and parcel of the package. And that's a big deal. It's really clearly true that that's a big part of the story in the research on cohabitation. The part that we've added to it is this, and this isn't, selection's usually contrasted with what are called experience reasons for a phenomenon in research, or things that could be potentially more causal. And this is a causal explanation that I'm about to describe. And it's this, that cohabitation creates more inertia around a relationship that makes it hard to break up. So inertia is the property of an object. Here's my iPhone. This has a certain amount of inertia, and what that means, if you fondly remember your physics, is inertia is how much energy it would take for me to take this and move it from where it is right now to move it here. Or if it's moving through space, which Einstein would say everything is relative to everything else. Inertia is how much energy it takes to move something off the trajectory it's on right now onto another one, or to stop it, or to get it going, or whatever. That's what inertia is. Cohabitation, now here's, let's come back to this word constraint. Cohabitation is more constraining than not cohabiting. Cohabitation has more inertia than not cohabiting. And that's the number one thing that young people don't see these days, is that cohabiting, all of the things being equal, makes it harder to break up. Now, remember what I said, cohabiting relationships are increasingly likely to break up. It's not that they don't break up. The issue is how likely are they to break up, everything else being equal, to a dating relationship where the two people aren't cohabiting. That's the comparison. So let me tell you how we got to that insight. So I'm looking at a data set in the late 90s. It was a national married sample asking people how they were doing in their marriages. And one of the findings that I was looking at one day, which stunned me, because we asked people, well, did you live with your mate before marriage? And we measured things like dedication and measured a number of other simple, you know, things you can measure in 10 minutes pretty simply in a phone survey with married people. So did you live with your mate before marriage? And one of the findings that was really strikingly clear in this data set is that the men who said that they lived with their wives before marriage were on average, remember, everything's on average when you're talking research, were on average substantially, like really significantly less dedicated to their mate. Everybody's married now. Now that they're married, they're less dedicated to their mate than the men who said they didn't live with her before marriage. So think about that. So everybody's married. Everybody's walked the aisle or gone to the Justice of Peace or something. I restricted the sample to married within 10 years because I wanted to get rid of cohort effects, like, you know, people that got married 50 years ago and stuff. I just wanted recent marriages. And the people that said that I lived with my wife, the guys that said I lived with my wife before marriage, on average scored significantly lower on how dedicated they said they were to their wives on one of my measures of dedication. Now, I just want to call attention to this. Sometimes we get this interesting kind of sex difference and sometimes we don't. Whenever we get it, it tends to be, like I said earlier, in this 2-to-1 kind of thing, with the male being the more committed one, or the female being more committed than the male, but about 1/3 of the times it flipping the other way. But this is one of the first times we really got this kind of interesting effect, and it was in this particular direction. And I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at that, and looking at that, and I'm thinking, what does that mean? Now, keep in mind, so now here I'm a researcher that thinks a lot about commitment in two ways, not just dedication, or what social psychologists would just call commitment in the tradition of research in that field, especially kicked off by a woman named Carol Rusbold. I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, wow, because I started thinking about the constraint part. Some of you guys married somebody you wouldn't have married if you'd never moved in with them. Your dedication was never as high to this person, and you got stuck because of the way cohabiting increases the constraints prematurely in the relationship. You see where I'm going here? Now, that's a hypothesis. That's a possible explanation for a finding that I'm looking at. It relates, by the way, it was interesting. I had dinner with one of the deans of sociology in the U.S. We had dinner together in either 99 or 2000 at a convention, a conference at BYU, Norville Glenn. And what was fascinating is I had just been really captivated by this idea of inertia, and we're talking, and he's starting to get captivated about this idea that we're not paying enough attention to how relationships form in the field of studying marriage. And what he was talking about is, I think there's a lot of premature entanglement. The people get overly entangled really quickly and prematurely and then get kind of stuck. And sociologists in particular, compared to psychologists, I'm a psychologist, have tended to focus a lot on mate selection over the years and the process of what's called assortative mating and how people sort of settle into who they end up with. And one of the things in that literature is how adequate a person searches in looking for the right sort of partner. So what Norval was saying, now I'm just focusing on the inertia part and what it means for the development of commitment. And Norval's focused on a very interesting other part that all goes hand in hand. He's saying, I think some people prematurely cut off their search. And it's like a game of musical chairs. It stopped too soon and they sat down in the wrong seat. Which is a great way, by the way, to terrify young people about why they might want to be going slower and being a little more careful about who they land with. There's also other research that sort of fits some of these things. Some researchers at BYU have this nice study with a large sample testing what's called sexual restraint versus sexual compatibility matching, which are two theories. One theory is that people should really have sex with a lot of people so they can figure out what they really like and who they want to be with. And then the other one is that the longer people don't have sex in a relationship, the more they can actually learn important things about the other and communicate and see if they're really compatible in terms of values and beliefs. And you know, some people can actually wait till marriage to have sex. I know that's rare. It really is rare, just to be clear. But, you know, that's the furthest extension of that theory. But even what they find, just waiting a couple of months makes a difference. And the reason why it's going to make a difference is people are going to learn something that tells them, well, you're not for me. But when all the chemistry and the sexuality and everything's rolling, people don't learn a lot of anything. Okay? No, they can maybe learn something. But they're, you know, we're blinded by the chemistry then. And Sharon Sassler, a sociologist, has a nice study where they argue that sex too soon, and this is a very liberal sociologist saying that sex too soon leads to living together too soon, which leads to greater odds of remaining with a less well-matched partner, that's based on our stuff, which leads to lower marital quality, lower relationship quality over time. That's pretty cool. Now, here's the crux. Greater constraints in living together than dating, all other things being equal, and this is what people don't easily see. So let me mention just a couple of the tests. This is a very powerful theory, and it's powerful in this way. Is everything we've thought of so far that we've had time so far to test that this idea predicts holds true. It's a very powerful predictive theory. So I think it really speaks to something that's very true. So one thing that this predicts, and this might make you slightly uncomfortable, but you'll see where this goes, is inertia should be a non-factor for those who've clarified mutual long-term commitment prior to the constraints increasing, so prior to cohabiting. So that prediction, which was first tested by Galena and me in the early 2000s with one of our long-term data sets that we have with Howard Markman, is that people who cohabit only after marriage, so either wait all the way to marriage, which is about 30% of people, or at least only cohabit after they've become engaged, are going to look different. They're going to look better than, on average, the people that cohabited before that was clear, before that big question about the future was nailed down. Because it's that latter group that could possibly be subject to inertia. It's that latter group that are taking the extra risk of making it harder to break up before they've clearly mutually decided that they have a future. That's the issue with that group. This finding's been obtained in every test of it. And all of these studies have this finding in it, and that's six different studies in five different data sets show this finding. What's fascinating about that is the big secret's finally sort of coming out about social science, which is the, especially social psychology, but all of social science, is a lot of really interesting findings don't replicate, meaning they're not going to happen more than once. If you see some really fascinating, weird result in the media, there's a lot of times it's the case where that's the only study that's ever going to get that finding. And what you really are interested in is findings that are replicable, that people keep finding in different data sets, different research teams, something here keeps popping up. That's probably something that's actually true. We get enamored in this country with a lot of things that aren't true. So I want to be clear on the theological side for a moment before I roll on to some fun stuff. I'm describing a scientific prediction that's well supported and replicated. I'm not making theology. And you can tell these findings line up pretty well with probably the theology about marriage and timing and sequence that many of you have, but it's not perfect. And don't expect social science to be perfect. And certainly don't expect social science to be perfectly validating your worldview. because that's not who most social scientists are, and they're not even going to be asking the questions that could obviously possibly do that. But this is actually getting pretty close to some reason why some of what you'd see as traditional wisdom and teaching in Scripture and teaching in the church, you know, it's that stuff sort of makes sense when you start thinking about this, which gets to a really important issue. As young people today, they really don't usually just want to know what's right or wrong, or what the Bible says, or what the pastor says, or what the parents say. They really do need some why. And this is a great area where the why can actually slow people down long enough to think, oh, well, maybe there was some wisdom about some of those customs. Maybe there was some logic to why I would be more careful or go more slowly or do things in a certain sequence. So the crux here is that constraints increase substantially prior to dedication maturing. So back to this study, this national data set that we have, which is just a fantastic data set. The funding has run out. If you know anybody with a lot of money, we need money to actually keep doing analyses like this in this data set. So if you know anybody that's got a lot of money that wants to know findings like this, let me know. Now, Galena and I, and this is really led by Galena, this is very smart, thought, okay, here's another way to test another sort of prediction from what inertia says. And this is pretty cool because, and I don't need to explain all the words on that particular chart, but keep in mind what I said, that the selection issue is a big issue in social science. And one of the ways that you can deal with selection is by trying to control for the variables when you're controlling two different groups, like the people that cohabited or the people that didn't. That has a lot of problems, though, because those groups are always different on other things that you didn't even measure and that you can't completely control for. It's a flawed strategy. And it's more powerful when you can compare people to themselves. So in this case, we're going to compare people. So we have this longitudinal data set. And we can watch people who starts to live together and what's true in that relationship in the time points going up to living together versus what's true after living together. So now the selection, there's still selection issues of a different sort, but now we can watch people in terms of how they just change in terms of what they say about their own life with all of the things about themselves then being actually controlled for because they're the own control. So here's what happens on a couple of variables in the transition to cohabitation in this sample. So the middle point there, the transition, that's lining everybody up in the data set in terms of the before and the after of cohabiting. So one thing that happens here is that dedication's increasing in the time points before moving in together, and then when people move in together, on average, it levels off. Now there would be plenty of people in there, by the way, where it keeps on going up. And there'd be plenty of people where it goes down, or maybe goes down rapidly, but on average it just levels off. And I'll just make one point about this. Where that's leveling off on this particular, that's a 7-point scale of a measure, and it's leveling off at about 5.8. That is not nearly high enough for a couple to get married. Because a couple that's getting married and really doing well and really strong is going to have a number near 7. 5.8 isn't that number. And this measure tends to be skewed. So 5.8 is actually pretty different than like 6.8. So that levels off. So dedication doesn't keep going up. Negative communication takes an immediate jump and then starts to climb up. And Galena had a great interpretation of this because she said, you know, a lot of what happens for people in cohabiting, especially the non-engaged cohabitors, but we didn't pull them out separately in this data set, is they are now moving in together and now they're working on two things at the same time. They're not only working on what people historically have always worked on moving into marriage, which is who does what and how do we do this, sort of how do we do home together and all that kind of stuff you have to negotiate and figure out. That's all in play. But this couple still has in play the issue about whether we have a future together. So they have two big developmental tasks going on at the same time instead of just one. We haven't nailed down the one about the future while we're also starting to work on how do we sort of do life together in terms of run a home. And in marriage, just in ideal circumstances, you're going to get that too. You're going to get the conflict going up because there's just more stuff to deal with. But that was a pretty interesting thought about dealing with two developmental things at the same time. Now, this is one of our measures of constraints, and I just want to say they're increasing before they move in together, and then they take a whopping jump up. See, we're in a different category all of a sudden. This is an all of a sudden thing, which is exactly what inertia says. You're about to make it harder to break up. You're increasing your constraints. In this case, there's a whole different set of kinds of constraints measured here related to this stage of relationship. And then you'll notice how much they accelerate. Now they're really going up fast. And this is exactly what this theory predicts. So if cohabitation is associated with increased constraints, people would be careful about that, right? No, because it's just part of dating now. And even in terms of part of dating, and this was starting to become clear 10 years ago, this next point, even when cohabitation was even still somewhat more serious than it is now even, because it's changed so fast, if people don't make decisions about cohabiting, they don't talk about it, they slide into it. This was first found by an Australian researcher, Jo Lindsay, in a paper she published in 2000. She talked about this. Manning and Smock, who've done a lot of work in cohabitation, talk about this from qualitative data in 2005. In our quantitative data in this relationship development study, at the first time point, of those that are cohabiting, roughly two-thirds say something more like sliding than something like deciding in terms of how they moved in. And what sliding looks like, you see it occasionally on sitcoms. There's been a couple different ones that are pretty funny examples of this. The pilot episode of the show Spin City, which I think you might be able to find on YouTube at 7 minutes and 25 seconds in, has one of the most hilarious like 3-minute sequences of how a couple slides into cohabiting that you could find. So if you find that on YouTube, 7 minutes, 25 seconds in, it's hysterical. I'll just leave that at that. Now, in this data set of those that are married, so I'm back to this before I do report, and I'll say a couple other things about it before I'm done. One of the things we asked, for those that did start living together before marriage, we said, well, how did you start living together? And they could give, this is just one item, they could give an answer from we didn't think about it or plan it, we slid into it, to in the middle, we talked about it, and then we just sort of, it just sort of happened, so that's still sliding-ish. But all the way on the other end, we talked about it, planned it, and then made a decision to do it together. So that's a really deliberate kind of, we didn't slide into it. Now, by the way, the sliding, deciding thing is kind, it's related to the inertia stuff, but we're on a separate dimension now. Now we're talking about deliberateness. I'm assuming the inertia part, that cohabiting takes more inertia or has more inertia than dating, everything else being equal. Now we're talking about the process of entering this more constrained state. And among the marrieds, now this is all these people that are married in the first years of marriage now, those who cohabited before marriage and gave an answer that was sort of more to the left reported lower marital quality early in their marriages than those that said, we really talked about it and made a decision. So independently even of these other things, it matters. Now why does that become important? It's this, commitments are fundamentally decisions. And the reason is because commitment is fundamentally making a commitment, making a choice to give up other choices. Anytime we're making a commitment, commitment is making a choice to give up other choices. So that's a line from my book, The Power of Commitment. This is a great one-liner that describes why commitment would be such a fundamentally difficult problem in a culture like ours, because what are we encouraged to do? Hang on to every option. Not give up anything. Why would you give up an option? Why would you limit yourself? We're taught not to limit ourselves and that it would be wrong. That, you know, you shouldn't be limited. You should hang on to everything and be able to have everything. Well, you actually, and most of you all know this, but a lot of people don't yet know this, you can't have it all. Okay? You're not going to have it all. You can't have it all. You make choices, and a lot of the biggest choices in life, whether we recognize it at the time looking back or forks in the road where we're either going to go down path A or we're going to go down path B, and that has huge implications. When we're making a clear choice about that, we recognize that I am making a choice for A and I am giving up B. That's a fundamental aspect of commitment. Now, I want to play a little video. This is on YouTube for the moment. I say for the moment because we may or may not leave it on YouTube, but we've had it up there for about 2 or 3 months. It's also, if you're interested in this video and you just want to play it for groups, if it's still on YouTube, you could certainly do that. You can also get this. It's just 4 minutes, but it's very expensive to produce, so we sell the disc for $20 if you're interested. It's called Relationship DUI. But if you Google today Relationship DUI, it'll be the top link. You'll get there easily. But watch what this describes about what I'm telling you. This is our team at our, so I have the university side, and we have a team at a company called PrEP where we make tools and curricula and things for people to use that work with couples. And this is one of the things the team made in the last few years that they didn't even show me until they were done, and I actually teared up when I saw it because I thought it was so unbelievably well done. Because they get this message. This is like talking to the middle of the street. This isn't like necessarily talking to the converted and preaching to the choir. This is talking to the culture. And they get it just right without being preachy.
You're not sure what happened exactly, but you realize that while this person is great, they're not great for you. You'd like to break up, but you're more locked in than you realize. What about that car loan? How much will it cost to break your cell phone contract? Will there be a custody battle over Princess? And just imagine how much harder it would be to break up if both your names are on the lease.
Wow. How in the world did this happen? You acted on the belief that you had a timeless love, but in reality, you had a time-limited chemical high. When you first fall for someone, the brain makes and releases an abnormal amount of chemicals in your body that affect how you think and feel. For example, there's dopamine, norepinephrine, and oxytocin. These are some of the chemicals that make us feel happy, energetic, and connected to others. During this period, you're in an altered state of mind, a kind of drug state. So it makes sense to do the kinds of things that join your lives together, little things that lock you in. But the high doesn't last forever. At some point, your chemical levels will become abnormal. And the same person you locked in with in your drug state is, in many cases, not the person you see yourself with for the long haul, but you locked in before giving yourself a chance to come to. What is the better way? Take your time to enjoy one another without doing the things that make it hard to break up. Go ahead and fix up the current lemon. Don't sign for a new car. Buy Princess the fish, not Princess the puppy. Keep your own place. Don't sign a lease together. Decide to do the things that bring you closer. Don't slide into the things that lock you in. So what's the big takeaway from all this? Again, take it slow so you don't get a DUI. Decisions under the influence.
I think a lot of people, if you could just get people you know to go slower, a lot would go better for them. So sometimes when we don't have the time to like explain a lot conceptually or to give more reasons, if you can just get somebody to go slower, there's a lot of people, if they had waited like 4 weeks longer, 6 weeks longer, 8 weeks longer before having sex with somebody, before moving in with somebody, before whatever, their whole life would be different. Because in 4 or 8 weeks longer, they would have seen something they hadn't seen yet, and they'd be on a different path. And I think, by the way, while disadvantaged folks, people at really lower education, lower SES, are whoppingly at greater risk in terms of marriage and difficulties in relationships and having instability for the children, I think this kind of stuff is just as great a risk, if not even greater, for people like the students at Pepperdine. To fall into this trap and get sort of connected too soon and have trouble moving on, I think, is a big deal. So what sort of relationships do people slide through? People slide through sex, into sex. They slide into cohabitation. They slide into pregnancy and having children. All these really important life-altering transitions are things now that people commonly slide into. And I think this is another way to think about what's fundamentally transformed about how we do relationships and the development of marriage in American culture now compared to 40 years ago. And this is a sea change. I want to mention a few findings from the Before I Do report and then just say some general things about the risk of sliding, which are some great ways to talk to people about this. If you go and find this report, the Before I Do report, online at the National Marriage Project, there's many, many more findings, but let me just highlight a few that are related to these kinds of transitions. One of the things that we find in that sample that's married, so these are the people that got married that we followed over time, who probably are many of the lower risk people actually in the whole sample. The most typical person in the sample had 5 sexual partners before marriage, which is, the more sexual partners, by the way, the somewhat less lower marital quality. Does it guarantee lower marital quality? No. These people, no, nothing here dooms somebody. It's really important to keep that in mind. In fact, I often think Christians in particular overstate research findings. You don't need to overstate research findings for people to kind of get the point. Everything's on average. Nothing dooms somebody. And you should realize, even theologically, the uncomfortable truth that you can do everything exactly right and struggle a lot in life. And you can do almost everything wrong and just skip through life and everything seems to keep turning out fine. Even Jesus teaches very clearly about that in a couple of disturbing sort of parables. Remember the little part where he talks about the tower falling on these guys and, well, what was special about them? He sort of says nothing. Tower just fell on them. Doesn't that make you feel great? thanks, Lord. Wow. So, got a high ceiling in here. Yeah. Ever cohabited with someone else? The serial cohabitation thing is a big thing and it's taking off. And I don't mean Cheerios, I mean people cohabiting with more than one partner before they finally settle down. It's strongly associated with not doing as well in marriage. Having children from prior relationships, a very big deal now. Because of how long marriage is put off now and everything that happens in people's lives before they finally settle down. And the fact that, the real fact that childbearing is now pretty whoppingly disconnected from marriage in American culture. Means that there's many more people now that have children in tow from prior relationships while they're trying to form their first marriage. That's just a very common thing. And this isn't saying, I'm not saying anything here dooms people, and I'm not saying people here, given the culture, people are often making not great choices, but it's not like they're bad people in some particular way. They're kind of doing what the culture says and the culture gives them, but these things increase risk. The relationship began by hooking up. Those relationships do a little less well in marriage. And only had sex with future spouse. So 23% of these folks in this sample that got married could say that I only ever had sex with this one person. And our study here on relationship quality and a study by Jay Teachman in 2003 with a big national data set looking at the outcome of divorce finds the same thing. So number of sexual partners isn't a great thing. So again, findings are always on average, nothing dooms somebody, but these are all things that either give or affect the edge somebody's going to have in achieving their dream to have that kind of Genesis 2:25 sort of lasting sense of real security and commitment and love. Now I want to give you, before I get to my favorite part to sort of say in this talk, conceptually, I want to give you 4 of the really strong conceptual reasons in the history of sort of theory of relationships why having more experience before marriage would maybe not be a great thing. I mean, more sexual experience, more cohabiting experience, more parenting experience. Because this is a tricky thing to talk about with this culture and with young people, because in everything in life we're told that experience is great. You know, having more experience makes you better. Having more experience, you learn from things, you gain awareness, you make better decisions, you're more skilled. And racking up a lot of experience in terms of relationships actually doesn't turn out to be so great. And here's the four best reasons why this is true. It's hard to nail down like any one thing, and probably some reasons more true for somebody than somebody else. And as I said, just don't forget this. I mean, there's some people that they do everything the high-risk way and life still turns out fine for them, at least in anything you could see or measure as a researcher. One is increased awareness of alternatives. When people have a lot more experience with other people before they finally settle down, one of the things that happens, keep in mind what I said, is commitment is making a choice to give up other choices. So that means among all my alternatives, I'm choosing one when it finally comes down to that day or that point in my life. Doesn't mean all the others disappeared, right? That's the thing about the wedding day, is I'm choosing this one, but I couldn't wave a magic wand on that day and have all the other options disappear. That doesn't work that way. We don't go live on a deserted island when we say our vows. And a lot of people believe this, so there's a lot of evidence that this is a big deal, that the more aware people are of alternatives, the more difficult time they will have maintaining the path that they've committed to. Alternatives, it's great to have alternatives in life, but having a deep, ongoing awareness of alternatives is the enemy of maintaining commitments. It really makes it difficult when we keep being aware. And so the more experience somebody has, the more sense they're going to have deeply implanted in their mind that there's other fish in the sea. And so if this is getting a little tough, you're not treating me so worshipfully right now, you're not my soulmate in the way I thought the soulmate thing was supposed to work, which means you would never challenge me and you'd only ever support me and do whatever I want. That's what I think some people actually mean by soulmate. Other people mean something positive, which is sharing life at a sort of deep level of the soul and major beliefs and values and sort of goals together. That's a great thing. The other stuff's not so great. Change expectations. Now just think about this in terms of sex. If somebody's had, let's just say somebody's had 7 sexual partners compared to a person that's only ever had sex with their spouse, when they struggle a little bit, or they may struggle somewhat at times sexually in their marriage, because things aren't always magical and wonderful, the chemistry's not always super powerful, and people have concerns sexually in their marriages. There's nothing really particularly new about that. It's just a reality. And some people have real struggles there. That's sort of another level. But let's just take the garden variety marriage with pretty good sex, you know, and frequent enough sex or whatever. But one person's got this sort of bigger history of partners. When that person's a little unhappy with how things are going sexually, there's a different kind of set of calculations that can happen in their head than it can happen for other people. Some people can get to the same problem, by the way, with pornography. But let's just talk about the actual real history of sexual partners. If I start sort of wondering about the quality of sex in my marriage and I've had 7 sexual partners, and I'm going to start comparing my marriage to those partners, what do you think the average person does? Do they start comparing marriage and marital sex with the person they married to the person who was the crummiest, lousy, least interesting, least exciting, least giving sexual lover they ever had? No. They're going to compare their mate to the... It's actually even worse than the best of the 7. It's not even just the best of the 7. They're going to take, well, this person did this really well, and this person did this really well. And wow, that was a great thing that that person could do. And then they're going to blend that into this thing that now that's who I'm going to compare this person I've chosen to live my life with. How fair a comparison is that? I mean, who can beat that comparison? It's just, now, there are some couples that have the most stupendous, amazing sex life. It's better than anything any other couple on the planet ever could have. Any of them maybe in Southern California? I don't know. But you get that. So more practice breaking off relationships. More relationship experience at sort of a deep level, you also kind of can start to get good at moving on or dealing with the loss. That's not a terrible thing. When you need to move on, people need to move on. But people do get practiced at things they've done a lot of. So if the marriage gets really tough at some time, some people have lower constraints and bail too quickly on a marriage that would have turned out fine if they had hung in there. If they'd made it through that difficult 2-year period, they'd made it through this, they had reinvested because they had this strong sense that I really committed to this and I'm sticking there. A lot of people get through those periods, and then there's a couple later on in life that they say, well, there's a number of times where we almost blew apart, or where things were really tricky, or I didn't like you so much. But here we are now, and we've done life together, and we got through stuff. That's a very cool thing that a lot of couples don't get to experience anymore because many bail too soon. And then I already talked about the stunted relationship development. So when there's a lot of things happen sort of fast and furious in relationships as they develop, other things aren't really learned. People aren't really learning about compatibility. They're mostly just sort of changing what social psychologist T-Bone Kelly called the comparison level for alternatives. What I think is available out there that I'm comparing you to. So here's what I think happens now in how we do relationship formation in this country. So here's a lower risk sequence. I get information about this relationship. Things are going slow enough that I figure out, is this risky? Is this good? Is there compatibility? Is there symmetry in the commitment? Is it mutual? I make a decision. So I'm not just sliding through stuff. I'm kind of thinking about what I'm doing and I'm making some decisions. Whether or not we would all approve of every decision, this is a decision maker, okay? And then some transition happens. It could be just right into marriage. But it could be about sexual contact, living together, having a child or whatever. But just there's a decision that precedes this transition. Now, one of the things that's interesting about this model is you'll notice the vertical dimension in this yellow box of the transition. That's where actually most of the cultural arguments have been, and those are good arguments to have, by the way, about the nature of sequence and timing. People really do better if they get going a bit in life, they reach maybe the age of 23 or 24 or so, then they get married, then they have children, you know, then they build a life together. That sequence is really associated with a lot more success than what the average person in America is doing now. So there is a sequence here that really matters, but I'm focusing on this other dimension right now for this point. This last box says inertia and constraint. And what I want you to just think about is there's different ways to think about constraints in terms of the structure of one's life, relational, moral, biological, health, etc. I just want to say, as I get to the next slide, that red box always follows the yellow box. And what I mean by that is these transitions come, I'm going to come back to your word now, they come with consequences. After the transition, I am not the same as I was before, and my life is altered either a bit or a lot. Researchers can't always measure everything, and you know, I can't always, like, you know, pregnancy and childbearing, pretty sure that's life-altering for most women. I'd say probably all women, and a lot of men. But I just want to say that the constraints follow the yellow box. Here's how we do relationships in America now. We slide through the transition. The constraints increase, so I now have fewer options than I had before, and now I get information about whether that was a great place to be. See how poorly placed where the information is? I'm going to get the most valuable information after I've already sacrificed some of my, what a statistician would call degrees of freedom in life. The things that I still have full volitional control over that I can decide about, I am now diminished in those in some way, and I'm getting this information after I have sacrificed some of my options now for the future. Which leads to one of my favorite lines, which is a lot of times people are giving up options before they made a choice. That's the problem with the new paradigm and how people do romantic relationships and sexual relationships in America now, and in much of the world, is people are giving up options before they've actually chosen what they want. And they don't see that this is happening, but they experience that this is happening. Looking back, people can see that's exactly what happened to me. I know exactly what you're talking about. That happened to my uncle, that happened to my sister, that happened to my roommate. But nothing in the culture told me that that was something that could happen, because I was doing things that I was told are low risk and that are safe. For some people, the slide is particularly bad because they not only slide through something that's really life-altering, but it's a very high cost that came with that. So now maybe there's a child, but there's not two people committed together to raising that child, which means one person, most often the woman, now has that child in tow. And what are that person's odds now in the market? You know, now I'm looking for, you know, some of those people do great, by the way. And some of them are obviously very good parents. But now that person still wants to be married and find somebody, but that relationship didn't work and they're still looking, but now I have a child. This is much more complicated for me now on the market. And there is a market for mates. And people have varying levels of attractiveness and things to offer. And offering already having children or lost a lot of options in life diminishes that person's options. So here's the big deal, like I said about sliding. It's losing options before making a choice. And that's because sliding generates constraints before dedication is fully developed. In contrast, healthy commitment, this is really important for people to understand, is about freely choosing constraints. And transition is not necessarily transformation. People are going through transformations all the time. And here's an example of what transformative understanding of marriage is. Nancy and I and Kyle Luke were coming back from the zoo about 10 or more years ago, so the boys were like, they were probably 12 and 10, 12 years ago. And Nancy's very good at catching that I versus me sort of thing, you know, grammatically. And I said I when I should have said me, or I said me when I should have said I. And she turns around and says, hey boys, I want you to watch something. I'm like, okay, I'm going to instruct the boys now in a life lesson about marriage. So your dad goes around the world speaking, and he gives talks, and he writes books and papers and all. But I can still improve him. See, you know, he has trouble with his I and me. So she's trying to teach them a lesson about marriage, right? She says, I can improve him. And I said, and Nancy's very, very quick, I said, I'm not sure I want to be improved. And Nancy said, if you didn't want to be improved, you shouldn't have gotten married. It's pretty awesome, because that's an implied sense that marriage is different. You know, marriage isn't just being like perfect. Marriage is choosing somebody. It's making a clear decision, not sliding into something, and then recognizing you're going to change each other through life. You're accountable to each other. You're going to give to each other. I'm going to end on this anecdote just real quickly with 1 minute, and then we'll close. A fabulous picture in contrast to sliding in Scripture metaphorically and historically about a real clear crossing over, a real clear deciding and not sliding into something, is when the Israelites finally go into the Promised Land. So they've wandered for 40 years, and that generation's died off in the desert, except for Joshua and Caleb. And they come up to the River Jordan, and this is stories in Joshua 3. It's fascinating because what they do, remember, the priests march into the river, the water stops, right? And in fact, if you read Scripture carefully, it stops in some city like further away. Just flat out, the water stops. And here's the priest standing there with the ark. So God's going in the transition before. Water stops. I'll come back to that in a second. And right now, we're on this side of the bank of the river, and we're going to cross over. There's a very clear, we were here, and now we're here. This is a very strong kind of transition that really denotes something new and something different. We're going through a portal. The river, I was thinking about this 2 weeks ago, and I'd never thought of this before, but of course the river needs to stop just pragmatically for them to get to the other side. But what's really fascinating to me about this that I thought of about 2 weeks ago was, rivers often denote the flow of time. And if you take that idea in the story, it's like time is stopping. It's not even like this is not a continuous thing. This is not a continuation of what went before. This is a very clear, we're here now on this side of the line, and we're crossing over to this side of the line, and then we're going to mark it with some stones. This is a very strong kind of transition that really sets up the most powerful kind of commitment. Did that mean everything was perfect for the Israelites once they get in the Promised Land? No. Challenges, goof-ups, sin, struggles, difficult people, all of that's the case, but there's a clear transition, and that's what people lack today. So what I think we need to look for doing in this culture and how society has changed is to recognize that people are sliding through all kinds of things, and they don't see that they're giving things up. That's lesson number one. And they also don't see that sliding doesn't get you a clear conviction that I chose this path, I chose you, and we were here, and now we're there. And we can really help people see those things and slow them down and help them make some better decisions as they're preparing for a life together in marriage. Thank you very much.
Scott has written this wonderful book. Scott, how long has this book been?
This book just came out. The first edition was 1998, and we came out with this new edition of A Lasting Promise in 2014, so just a year ago. It's got a lot of great new stuff in it. We're very pleased with it.
So I would encourage you, I think we have this in the bookstore, so I would encourage you to stop by and get a copy of this book if you don't have that yet. One of the professors at Seaver was telling us last night she uses this book not only to teach about marriage, but also how to teach about how to do relationships in a healthy way. So I encourage you to do that. This is the flyer that has the Boone Center track on it. We have several classes the rest of this week. If you want to stop by the booth outside of the lecture hall and get a copy of this, we have a lot of other excellent speakers, just like Scott, for you to hear. This afternoon, my husband, Terry Hargrave, is speaking on forgiveness. If you've tried to sign up for that and it notes that session is full, I'd encourage if you have time, if you have some extra time and you want to go by and see if there's some seats to go on and do it, because we all know that when we come to Bible lectures and we sign up for things and it's really pretty outside, that sometimes we're called to spend time with a friend over coffee and not get to the seminar that we signed up for, so we might have some extra seats. Thank you guys, and I'll be at the back, and Scott will be here to answer any other questions.